Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 6th of January. This hour of the program, Alan Alda is going to be joining us tonight. Human Spark, a three-part series, will be broadcast on consecutive Wednesdays on most public television stations, and it tackles a hot science topic, the fine line that separates humans from other species, from the Neanderthals to chimpanzees. How are we different from the other animals? How do we get that way? Where is it in the brain that these things have taken root? When did the human spark begin? Alan Alda, well, he has a long and illustrious history in film and television. Let me just tell you what happened to him in the year 2005. He received an Emmy nomination for his award as for his role as Arnold Vinnick, Republican candidate for the presidency on the West Wing, a Tony nomination for his role in the Broadway revival of David Mamet's Glengarry Glen Ross, and an appearance in Martin Scorsese's The Aviator, for which he received a nomination for an Academy Award and was also nominated for a British Academy Award. He has hosted the award-winning series Scientific American Frontiers on PBS, did that for 11 years, interviewing leading scientists from around the world, played Hawkeye, of course, on MASH, and wrote and directed many of those episodes. He began acting in the theater at the age of 16 in summer stock in Barnesville, Pennsylvania. His wife, Arlene, is the author of 15 children's books and is an award-winning professional photographer. He has three daughters, seven grandchildren. And I must say, which I learned last night after watching most of the three episodes, that he has the brain of a 40-year-old. We're so happy to have him with us. He's been with us before when he wrote his wonderful books and is an absolutely delightful human being. Alan Alda, hello.
Hello.
The brain of a 40-year-old. That must have made you feel good.
Oh, thank God. I thought you said the brain of a 4-year-old.
Well, that would have been okay, too, because then you could have gone even farther. Thanks so much for being with us again.
Thank you. It's fun to be here with you.
Whoops, we got a problem. There we go. And we also have with us Graham Chadd, who is the series producer of The Human Spark. Graham, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, Alan. Good morning.
Hey, hello, Graham.
Yeah. Alan, let's start with you on this. You just traveled all over the world for this series. It was just marvelous. I kept writing down the locations thinking, at some point in my life, I got to go there.
Yeah, we did. We went all over and talked. It's so interesting to go to some place, you know, a rock overhang in France, in this beautiful countryside, and find scientists there who know so much and are learning so much from tiny little pieces of stuff they find in the dirt, which they find with the equivalent of a toothbrush. I mean, they dig their way down through millennia with little brushes. I mean, it's just amazing how much care they take and how much they can learn from so little evidence. That always astonishes me.
Mm-hmm. Graham, this whole area is a hot science topic, isn't it? When we got the spark so we became humans.
It's what attracted Alan and I to the topic several years ago when we first started to think about this. We've been working together on, as you mentioned earlier, on Scientific American Frontiers for a while, and as we were drawing to the end of that, we were both struck by the fact that so many of the scientists we were talking to were sort of circling around the same question from all sorts of different disciplines. And so we thought it would be fun to try to put together a concentrated look at what makes us human from the perspective of the geneticists and the psychologists and the anthropologists and the primatologists and the brain scientists, and that's what we think we've done in these three episodes.
And did you have just oodles of scientists from whom to choose all over the world? Did you have to really narrow this?
Oh, yes. I mean, there are a lot of people involved in this now. And that was the fun, one of the fun things for me when developing something like this is the research phase, when I am trying to narrow the field, as you put it, or rather to expand the field of good people.
Graham spends an enormous amount of time lining up the people who I'll eventually talk to on camera. And the process, it seems to me, Graham, maybe I'm wrong about this, but it seems to me that you had to contend not only with finding the right people to talk to get down to the heart of the story, but the story kept changing as you were preparing the show.
That's
and
right.
certain avenues that you had first traveled down no longer seemed as important as others.
Really?
And new ones opened up, yeah. Huh. I what Alan's referring to specifically, I think, there is that when we first dreamt this up, everybody was very excited about the fact that having sequenced the human genome, having found out what our DNA is all about, scientists were on the verge of doing the same thing for the chimpanzee genome.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, one of our goals is to try to find out that while we share so much of our genes with chimpanzees, like 98-99%, the hope was that we could find in that other 1 or 2% the crucial differences that set us apart. It seemed like an obvious idea, right? But in fact, once they did get the chimpanzee genome all laid out, compared it to the human genome, there are so many differences, and it's all so very confusing, that you can't just pick up one gene, one stretch of DNA, and say, ah, look, there it is, there's the human spark. That's what we have that chimps don't have.
Mm-hmm.
And so that whole avenue, which excited us to begin with, we sort of left aside in the end and went off in other directions.
Hmm.
I may be wrong, but it seems to me that's one of the things that makes the program we came up with, the human spark, have an interesting element that may not be expected. There's a certain disparity of opinion about how much like us chimps are. Do chimps have some of the qualities we have, or are they just very good at being chimps and we're very good at being humans?
Well, and some of the experiments were fascinating between children and chimpanzees, how children really were able to learn from direction, receiving praise, and also helping each other, which the chimps didn't do.
The chimps help to a certain extent. What's that distinction, Graham? The chimps will help you if you're reaching for something. They'll reach for it.
But even that was slightly unexpected. The expectation was, in fact, chimps won't help at all.
Yeah, and, but there is that extraordinary shot where somebody's reaching, and the chimp looks at his hand, looks over at the thing he's reaching for, and says, oh, here.
Yeah. And in fact, since we filmed, there have been a couple of other experiments published which seem to suggest that chimps do help each other a little bit in getting stuff, basically, in getting something that you don't want. If you want it too, then there's no helping involved. And that's one of the huge differences between humans and chimpanzees. I mean, one of the things we really focus on is that we're helpful by nature, and chimps are only helpful if they think they're going to get something out of it.
Some of us are that way, too,
yeah,
right?
There's a nice too many of us.
Right, exactly. And one of those chimps was after you, Alan Alda, wasn't it? Oh, man,
he really scared the daylights out of me. You know, we were sitting on a bench. I was sitting on a bench with a scientist talking in a rational human way. And this chimp on the other side of the glass, in a natural zoo setting, slams himself against the glass just to announce that that's his territory. I suppose I asked the scientist, what did he mean by that? He said, he's just saying hello
and establishing that he was the boss.
Yeah,
sure did.
And then he did it about three or four more times, and every time he did it, I nearly leapt off the bench. It was frightening. These animals are very big and hairy.
That's one of the big surprises, actually, for people that don't know much about chimpanzees. You're so used to seeing, you know, the ones on TV, which are always babies. They're never older than a few years. And at that age, they are sort of cute. But once they get to be adults, they are terrifying. They're much more like gorillas than you imagine.
And the ones you see are usually trained to do what we think of as cute things.
Right.
Which many of the scientists studying them really despise. I mean, mm-hmm. they don't like the animals put through that.
The whole series is fascinating, but I found this study of language and this idea that I've always wondered why we were kids for so long. It takes us so long to learn how to do everything, and people have to take care of us for all these years. This long period of childhood, the series says, is a vital component of the human spark. Tell me more about that.
Why don't you go into that, Graham?
Okay, yes. It is true. Most other animals, I mean, when you think of, say a horse, or you know, a horse drops the foal and the foal's on its feet within about 20 minutes. And in the wild, most animals are able to cope pretty well, pretty quickly. They have to, because they have to look out for, be able to get away from predators. Now, chimpanzees keep their babies around them for a little while, for, you know, a year or two before they go off on their own. But we keep our children around for, you know, well, sometimes, in my case, 20 years.
You can't get rid of some of them.
But this has enormous advantages for the species, because it means that because we have such complicated culture, complicated language, so many things to know these days, just imagine how much you have to learn before you can really make your way out into the world and become productive.
Yes.
And so we need this very, very long childhood. And one of the interesting research avenues we pursue in the show is that we look back and we try to find out how long the childhood was, for instance, of Neanderthal children. And it seems that they did have a significantly shorter childhood. They were probably adult by the time they were 13, 14, something like that. So they have much less time to learn their culture than we do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's so much in the culture that has to be absorbed to make a functioning modern human. Excuse me. But if the brain that absorbed all of what we need to be a modern human were big enough at birth to handle that, the head would be so big it wouldn't make it through the birth canal.
That's right, yeah.
So,
right.
So partly we need a long childhood because we have to start out with less material, less brain material in the beginning.
Right. Most of the brain growth, a lot of the brain growth in humans occurs after birth for exactly the reason that Alan said, but also for another reason. The brain is hugely expensive in terms of its fuel needs.
Mm.
And a mother carrying a pregnant woman carrying a child not only has to feed her own brain, but she has to feed this rapidly growing brain in her baby, and it's just a colossal drain. And so that's another reason why we give birth to babies with relatively immature brains by comparison.
Also, what would a brain that has our capacity in the uterus for so long? What would it do? It'd have to write a lot of poetry about the dark and the water. And I mean, there wouldn't be much to do with the brain in
there. Wouldn't you love to read that poetry, though? That'd be fascinating. Let's spend some time on these Neanderthals who, as the series shows, just did kind of the same thing over and over and over again. They never learned things new. They never changed very much, while their counterparts in Africa were becoming quite sophisticated. Why did they do everything the same way for tens of thousands of years?
That seems like one of the most interesting questions that we get into on the show, to me, because they were so much like us. We and the Neanderthals were descended from the same group of animals, and they came up. They were part of the group that came up in that first wave out of Africa and found themselves in Europe, and that's where we found their remains. But a bunch of us stayed back in Africa and came up much later in a second wave, and that group of people, although closely related to the Neanderthals, had this ability, as you say, to change, to innovate, to create new tools and that kind of thing. And why? What was the difference between them? And the answer to that really gets to, as much as scientists are able to surmise it, the answer really seems to get very much to the heart of what makes us human. What is it about us? And that sense of innovation combined with other qualities we have to be social, this hyper-sociality we have. For instance, we spend a lot of our time wondering what the other person is thinking. What do you think of me? What do you think of Graham? And what do you think Graham thinks of me? And what do you think Graham thinks of me thinking of you? And it can go into about five different levels of this. And the sociability that we're capable of enables us, when we do invent something new, to spread it to other people. And the Neanderthals, probably, according to the scientists we've talked to, the Neanderthals probably not only lacked the ability to make interesting changes on that one stone tool that they used for so long, they lacked the ability, if anybody did come up with a change, they lacked the ability to spread that change to other people because they didn't have the same sociability we have. Plus, they were spread out geographically. Graham, how few were there spread all over Europe? I forget.
Yeah, it's a slightly debatable question, but I think one of the things that surprised both Alan and I was how few Neanderthals there were at any one time. You know, you think, oh, it was probably, you know, about the same number as maybe a little less than is in Europe today. But in fact, there were something around 10 or maybe 20,000.
Oh, my.
Throughout the whole
of Europe.
It's
a small town. I once lived in a town a mile square with 10,000 people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was nearly bucolic.
And they all lived in, you know, rock shelters and moved around. And so, but not much. The evidence is, too, that they didn't move around much. So there was very little contact between these separate little large family groups, which were really spread out. And so, as Alan said, you know, if there was a genius amongst them who came up with a really neat new stone tool that would have been great, it probably never spread to anybody else, and it would have died out when that group died out, when they probably did each
other. Or maybe
group.
When that guy died out,
yep.
Because they might not even have spread it among their little group living in their own rock shelter.
Interesting.
But there's another important point to make here, and that is that while they didn't change, one of the possible reasons why they didn't change is because they didn't need to change.
Mm.
They had developed a way of life in what was very harsh conditions in Europe then. It was during the Ice Age. They developed a way of life that worked. There was plenty of large animals around that they could kill by herding them over cliffs and things like that. And they didn't need to innovate. They were pretty successful. They were much more. I mean, I don't want to put down the Neanderthals, who were quite remarkable in many ways, but they were more like, in quotes, animals than we were, in the sense that they couldn't do much about their environment. They were like other animals. They lived in an ecological niche, and the niche that they were successful within it. And if in evolution, if it works, you don't change it.
Right.
Yeah.
And
on the other hand,
so it was working for them, and they didn't change it.
We unfortunately can do something about our environment, and we have.
Exactly.
Right.
And we change it all the time, and that feeds back and means that, you know, it changes who we are.
Well, what about language? Did they have any form of communication?
This is very controversial, and it's not really an area we get into because, it's, you know, how do you know?
Right.
You know, language just evaporates. It doesn't.
Yeah, but John Shea, one of the scientists we spent some time with, had a very interesting take on it. Obviously, as Graham just said and as John says, there's no fossil of language. You can't find actual evidence of language. However, he said once they developed this tool, this ability to throw a spear quite a long distance and hit an animal.
Now, wait a minute. We're talking about modern humans now, remember?
No, I'm saying I thought that's what we were talking about. I'm sorry. The language of the Neanderthals, is that what your question
was?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, now that we have no notion of. No.
Yeah. They probably had some rudimentary language, but not anything like as sophisticated as ours, and Alan was about to explain how our language became more sophisticated. Go ahead,
yeah, that there's an, and we don't have even of modern humans any way of knowing how much language they had, although John Shea brings up the idea that if you're going to hurl a spear at a big animal, you probably need more than one person to take part in this exercise. Because if all you do is get this big animal mad at you, you're done for.
Right.
So you need a strategy, and you need several people cooperating, which suggests that there must be some kind of at least early language.
Mm-hmm.
Another nice point that came out of the John Shea chat that we had that was reinforced later when we, in the third program of the series, when we check out Alan's brain. And that is, there's a nice analogy between putting together a complicated tool with various different pieces, which you can put together in different ways to make different things, and the way we put together sentences out of different pieces, different words. The order of the words changes what the sentence means, and the way you put together string and wood and stone and glue changes the tool you make. And there's a nice idea that the two things, you know, evolved simultaneously in our brains, that the ability to recombine things into novel, to create novelty,
so
both
we could
in language and in tools.
We could say that the making of the tools was the spark?
No.
It's hard to say. How would you say, Graham, that there is one thing you would call the spark?
I know. This is an interesting question, of course, and it comes up because we chose that title, which sort of implies that there is one thing. Well, I would say if there was one thing, I would say it's what Alan has already mentioned, and that is our extreme sociability, our cooperativeness, our collaborativeness, which stems in part from our communication skills, but also from what Alan was also talking about, our ability to check out, suss out what other people are thinking so that we can both outthink them, but also cooperate with them.
The amazing thing about that is that it's a sword that cuts both ways, because some of our greatest cooperation, and in fact some of our greatest altruistic behavior, occurs when we're at the height of non-cooperation, which is wartime. Whenever we raid another tribe or declare a world war on one another, we have to cooperate and sacrifice to a tremendous extent, far more than we do probably just moving through a city. Although just moving through a city requires enormous cooperation, too. I mean, all those little gestures that people have that are unspoken and usually unnoticed as they pass each other in a big city on a sidewalk, they maneuver. Hundreds of thousands of people maneuver without knocking into each other and without fighting with each other about being bumped and that kind of thing. There's a tremendous sense of cooperation there. But boy, when they make war on each other, they really have to cooperate.
Really. And that's what they, when you talk to people who have been in that situation, what guides them every day is taking care of their brothers and sisters, right?
Yeah.
It's the band. It's the band.
That's right. And it's not just your brothers and sisters. I mean, it's your group, you know, it's within. But it's even outside of that. I mean, you know, no other species sends care packages to tsunami victims in Southeast Asia. You know, we don't even know. Or when you read a book, you can feel empathy for somebody that you don't know. No other group can do that. No other animal can. There's evidence that within groups of chimpanzees, there's empathic behavior. People, that the individual chimpanzees will help relatives and comfort animals in distress. But they don't care at all about the group over the hill. In fact, if they encounter the group over the hill, what they're going to do is try and beat them up.
Yeah, and there's that great phrase that Franz de Waal said to us about chimps. He's a great chimp researcher. He said, if you have about 10 million people in New York, if you had New York populated by 10 million chimps, you would probably have a bloodbath.
Right. We're going to take phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Tonight on PBS, the beginning of a three-part series, The Human Spark. Tonight is Becoming Us. Program number two is So Human, So Chimp. And number three is Brain Matters, in which Alan Alda's brain is analyzed under an MRI. We have two guests with us. Alan Alda, who is the host of this series and chosen because of the work that he's done with PBS on science programs and because of his wonderful curiosity about the world and about science. And also joining us is the series producer of The Human Spark, Graham Ched. Phone lines are busy. But keep the number in mind, and also you can send an email if you'd like. That is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Walter Isaacson joins us the second hour of our program today. He is the CEO of the Aspen Institute and was managing editor of Time Magazine for a number of years. I think the last time we spoke with him was after he wrote the book Einstein, His Life and Universe. His latest book, American Sketches, Great Leaders, Creative Thinkers, and Heroes of a Hurricane. Walter is with us following the news at 10. All right, we go to phone calls now for Alan and Graham and start with Dave from Madison. Hello, Dave.
Hello. Thank you, and I'm looking forward to watching the series. I am kind of curious. One of my beliefs is that one of the highest traits of humans that other animals do not show us anyway is a sense of humor, a sense of irony, and we often use our humor to bring out the truth, to poke holes in pompous leaders like John Stewart does, and that sort of thing. And I'm wondering if you deal with that dimension of the human life.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you. I'm not, unless that chimp who kept flinging himself at the glass thought it was funny to do that, I wasn't aware of too much humor among the other animals we saw. What about, do you remember, Graham, did anybody come up with any sense of fun like that?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and I think you put your finger on an important difference. There's certainly not much of a sense of irony in other animals. There's some evidence that chimps can enjoy sort of slapstick humor. You know, when they throw feces at people, they think, it's wrong.
Yeah, they really like that. And some people think that's the lowest form of humor, but I don't know.
And in fact, you can tickle a baby chimpanzee. I wouldn't want to try and do it with a big one. You can tickle a baby chimpanzee, and they make these sort of panting pant hoots, which are a little bit like laughter. But I think that the highly sophisticated humor of people like Alan Alda is certainly beyond any other animal, and I think it is a very important human trait.
It probably has a lot to do with knowing something and then knowing what's off about something you've stated or something you've done. I mean, if you wear your hat in a funny way, you kind of know that it's funny because you have another picture in your head of how it's supposed to be worn. Or if you cross your eyes. Some people, you know, you can make a kid laugh that way, but that's partly because the kid knows that it's supposed to be the other way. So there has to be a certain amount of a map in the brain for that has to do with knowledge and a memory of how things are, and then comparing that to what you see before you can laugh, and that laugh response probably relies on a lot of the things that we've been talking about earlier about the sociability and the observation of the other people and knowing where you stand with them. That sense of hierarchy is very important in the sociability thing.
One of the people we talked to in the series is Robin Dunbar, who's at the University of Oxford in England. And, in fact, maybe I can put a little plug in here for our website. On our website for the Human Spark, you can find lots of videos, web-exclusive videos of things which are above and beyond the series. And there's a nice interaction that Alan has with Robin Dunbar on our website where he talks a little bit about laughter. He thinks that laughter was one of the very first things that groups of humans were able to do together when they sat around the campfire at night. And the sort of chorusing effect of the synchronizing effect of laughter, when somebody laughs, it makes other people want to laugh. Thinks that might have been an important building block of both music, which is another uniquely human characteristic, and finally even maybe of language.
And an interesting idea. Remember when we talked with Bob Provine? I think his name was Bob, right?
Yeah.
We didn't talk with him on this show, but we talked with him for a story on Scientific American Frontiers a couple of years ago, and he points out that most human laughter, but the vast majority of human laughter is not about things that are funny. It's a social mechanism. It's, you know, like you say, I almost spilled that on you. Meaning, hope it's okay what's going on between us. Or, mind if I cut in line? You know, we use laughter as a signal that we don't mean any harm and various other, we use it for various other signals. But if that's true, then that seems to play into what, Graham, you just said about the emergence of laughter possibly as a socially unifying event. And from that later, from that sociable need could maybe come, when you apply all the other abilities we have as humans, as modern humans, you can start to get laughter as an expression of, something's off here, and it makes me chuckle.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Arnette from Dodgeville next. Hi, Arnette.
Good morning, Mr. Alda. You do have a wonderful brain. couple things here. I just wanted to put a quick plug in for the canines. Dogs have, for thousands of years, been able to cooperate and observe human behavior and get along. In fact, they did a test one time with a dog, a domesticated dog, a chimpanzee, and a wolf, and to see if they would take human direction. And amazingly enough, the domesticated dog took direction better than the chimpanzee as far as observing human behavior.
And this is in the show as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. We met some extraordinary dogs in Leipzig, Germany.
Right, and dogs do have a sense of humor, too, if anybody's ever owned one. But my main reason for calling is I saw another fascinating show on PBS about the bonobo chimps. Mm. And they are, according to the show, they have a closer DNA connection to humans than chimpanzees do. And chimpanzees, I didn't know any of this before I saw the show, are more solitary creatures. They're more aggressive. Whereas the bonobos are matriarchal. They are very extremely cooperative. They bind together in groups where the chimpanzees, like I say, are more isolated. And they will welcome another group into theirs and get along fine and then sometimes join and sometimes not. And maybe that would account for the first Neanderthal being so sparse, maybe because they were more of an isolated species, and the second being more based in cooperation. Maybe this is where the human spark came from. Mm. And I will take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Annette.
Well, the bonobos really go in for the theory of make love, not war, too.
Yes, they do.
The bonobos have been very little studied so far, but they're beginning to become climatologists are getting very interested in bonobos these days for exactly the reason that your caller said. They are more, there's much more matriarchal, there's much less aggression within those groups. And so just research is just really beginning to see if they are actually able to cooperate more. There's some interesting experiments been done with chimpanzees on their ability to cooperate with each other in jointly pulling on a rope, for instance, to get food. If one, they both have to pull in order to get the food. If any one pulls, it doesn't work.
And, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
And chimpanzees can do that, but only under very, only if they know each other very well and are comfortable with each other. If they have any problems with each other, then they won't do it. It's hard to get them to cooperate. You can, but it's difficult.
Given all of those attributes that the bonobos seem to have, it would be interesting to hear scientists speculate, especially when they've studied them more. Why didn't bonobos become the animal that spread all over the earth with this technology that we have? Why they seem better able to cooperate than we do?
Yeah.
We don't quite know that yet. I was about to say that experiments to see if they do cooperate better are just really getting underway. Mm. We don't know whether they can cooperate more than we do. But remember, they went off. The thing that we left. The forest, basically. Our ancestors left the rainforests of Africa and went out into the wide, wide world, and we had to adapt to those new circumstances. Bonobos and chimps both stayed there, and they didn't need to adapt anymore. As we mentioned earlier on, if you fit an ecological niche, there's no reason to change very much. And so chimps and bonobos, who are sort of, they're different from each other because they're on opposite sides of the mighty Congo River. They don't cross over that river.
So we had wanderlust, and the bonobos just had lust. And it did us more good.
Well, the guy, you've already talked to the guy who's done all the research, Franz de Waal. He's the bonobo guy. And he studied a lot of bonobos here at the Milwaukee Zoo.
Yes.
So if you want to come to Milwaukee and do a show on bonobos, we'll take you out to lunch. It would be fun.
Franz is a great guy to talk to. I always enjoy talking to
him. He is interesting, isn't he? Yeah,
yeah.
Very interesting. Let's go next to Julie from Manitowoc. Hi, Julie.
Hi, good morning. I'm wondering if humans have a complex of capabilities or something like a future gene to deal with issues far off in the future, or relatively far off in the future, compared to their immediate needs for security, safety, sexuality, power, money, so that we have, a hope of being able to deal with global warming or even one's own personal health that involves decades into the future.
Yeah, at least one of the people we talked to related that ability to think in the future to our ability to think about other people's minds. And in a way, we were capable of exploring a future self of our own, as though it were another person, and that ability to think as a basic unit, to think of ourselves 10 minutes from now, or a day from now, or 10 years from now, becomes an important building block in arriving at a future? How would you say it, Graham?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, by the way, Julie, because it is crucial to who we are, and it is possibly, you know, we were saying just now that the human spark might be in our hypersociability, but also in this ability to project ourselves into the future, just as Alan said. No other animal can see. There's some evidence that rats and monkeys and other animals can see a little way into the future, just a few seconds, a minute or so maybe, but not much beyond that. I mean, when you see a squirrel storing away nuts for the future, it's not thinking, oh, yes, I better put these nuts away because it's going to get jolly cold soon. It's doing it because it's only
the
one
British
that did that
think
survived
that.
The winter. So. But we can you know, stock up our cupboards and think about getting through the winter, and we can think about, you know, what's going to happen, as the caller said, not just to ourselves, but to the world. And one of the things we found out, and this is comes right at the end of the series, end of the third show, and it's sort of the climactic point I think we make, is one that Alan was just referring to, and that is when we look inside Alan's brain with these, you know, scanning methods, we find that the area of his brain that allows him to figure out what other people are thinking, and the area of his brain that allows him to just have his mind wander, just daydream, imagine scenarios, imagine differences, are very close to each other. And it could be that, you know, they both evolve together. And as Alan said, we're thinking about other people when we think about ourselves in the future. In a way, we're thinking about our future selves, another person. And this is absolutely unique to humans.
Yeah. Let's go to Randall from Ripon. Hi, Randall.
Good morning to all.
Good morning.
I just was wondering, to revisit the Neanderthal situation, having had been a hunter myself, it made me think about when we're in a group, there's a lot of nonverbal communication taking place. And I think when you see, you know, Aboriginal hunter-gatherers, you know, a group of men cannot be shouting and talking to another, otherwise your game is gone. And I'm just wondering, could it be that the Neanderthals, maybe they didn't have a spoken language, but maybe through, you know, sign language or facial expressions, because it seems like there's volumes being spoken just through our body language, I mean, posture and so forth. And I just wonder if there's any, you know, if that's been looked into at all.
I'll take my question. And, of course, it's an impossible one to answer. I think you're absolutely right. I'm sure there was that. I'm sure those things happened. They would have had to. I mean, it looks as if most of the game that Neanderthals acquired were animals, big animals. They were huge animals then in Ice Age Europe, mammoths and large bison and things like that. And they probably were killed mostly by trapping them and driving them off cliffs and things like that. They didn't really have the weaponry with which to kill a large animal, because their stone tools were pretty crude, and they wouldn't have been made with spears, certainly not projectiles. So they must have been cooperation in this. If you're going to herd some big animals off the cliff, the guys would have cooperated amongst each other. But that leads me to your being a hunter is an interesting point, because one of the other remarkable things we discovered about Neanderthals, and one of the things that, as Alan right at the top of the show was mentioning, how amazing it is that scientists can piece together so much information from just tiny scraps of evidence. Looking at the bones and teeth of Neanderthals, you can figure out what they ate. And amazingly, it seems they only ate meat. They ate very few vegetables or berries, and remarkably, no fish, as far as one can tell, even though the rivers of Europe at that time would have been teeming with large fish. In fact, we know they were, because there's fossilized fish. But they not only, so as we said earlier, not only did they not change their hunting techniques or their technology, but it looks like they didn't change their diet. They just ignored all these other food sources around them.
That's remarkable.
Whereas our ancestors, you know, were omnivores. They ate anything they could get their hands on. And this gave them another advantage over the Neanderthals. When they came into Europe, the Neanderthals, there was only so much big game around. And if the big game was hunted to extinction, the Neanderthals were sort of stuck. But the modern humans had all these other food sources they could draw upon.
There is a remarkable, I can't remember the town, Alan, but the town where the display of the beads that were made out of teeth and soap material. It's really quite extraordinary. Can you tell us about that museum and this jewelry that was made, or at least it appears to be?
Graham would remember the name of the town that the museum is in. I can't remember it either. What do you remember, Graham?
Castanet.
Ah, yeah, Castanet. And these beads, some of which were made out of human teeth, were on display. But interestingly, when I asked Randy White, the scientist, how they had been worn, these beads, he said they were probably sewn on like sequins, and were probably very important in distinguishing where you were in the social order, and that already indicates a kind of sophistication from earlier animals.
Mm-hmm. There's no evidence, for instance, that Neanderthals had much body adornment, and certainly no jewelry of that sort. And again, it's another important difference. The scientists we talked to, including Randy White and John Shea, both think that that these beads were very important in symbolizing connections between groups that may not know each other. If you had the same sort of bead, it meant you had something in common. And the point that John Shea makes is that making these beads is tremendously expensive in time. And so it means they must have been valuable. There must have been a real selective advantage in having these things around to the group, because it could take hours to make one of these beads.
We
filmed John making one and from soapstone, which is a sort of a soft stone.
Yes.
And it took him, an hour to make one little bead.
And then the material would have been traded from one group to another, because they came over long distances, longer than you would expect anyone to travel individually. I may be exaggerating the importance of that, but it sounds to me like that indicates some kind of language beyond gestural language, to be able to trade materials like that.
Yeah, yeah. How many are you going to give me for that?
Yeah, right.
Let's welcome more phone calls in just one moment. We're talking about The Human Spark. It's a three-part series on PBS that begins tonight. It is hosted by Alan Alda, who is one of our guests. Tonight, Becoming Us looks at The Human Spark, and the second in the series concentrates on chimps. So human, so chimp. Program number 3, Brain Matters. Alan Alda is with us, as is Graham Chadd, who he is the series producer for The Human Spark. We have one line open if you'd like to join us in our remaining minutes. The number is 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Wednesday, Walter Isaacson will be with us. He has a new book, American Sketches. In its series of essays, he reflects on the lessons to be learned from Benjamin Franklin, Albert Einstein, Bill Gates, Henry Kissinger, Ronald Reagan, Mikhail Gorbachev, Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, and many other interesting characters that he has chronicled as a biographer and as a journalist. Back to phone calls now. We go to Cliff from Appleton. Hello, Cliff.
Good morning. I remember from an anthropology text in the 1970s called In Search of Ourselves that a burial site was found in Shanidar, Iraq, where Homo erectus remains were found in association with flowers. Pollen grains were thought to be one of the most durable substances on Earth, and the people who evaluated the site thought that these remains were laid to rest with flowers. And that would suggest Homo erectus could recognize death as a very significant transition from life. And their brains are probably twice as big as the Australopithecines. Maybe they were 500 cubic centimeters. Maybe these guys were 1,000. I think Homo sapiens may be 1,200. But it kind of suggested as our brains got bigger, we began to ponder the nature of our existence and recognize death indeed as something significant in a transition.
Ooh,
I'm just wondering what you thought.
You read that book well, Cliff. That's great. Chad, you want to take that?
You're absolutely right about that. The The site, although, is highly controversial, and the interpretation of that evidence is very controversial. There's very little other evidence that Homo erectus buried their dead symbolically like that. And one of the areas we get into again on our website, if you'd like to go there, is a burial, a Neanderthal, a possible Neanderthal burial at one of the sites that Alan and I visited in France. The site was interesting because it had been widely cited for several years as having a burial within it of a human child, which seemed to have been deliberately put into a pit. But in fact, as we found out when we were there, the archaeologists who are now examining this think it was not a burial. It was just a hole in the cave that the child had tumbled into or been just chucked into. And as I say, it's very controversial how much of ritualized burials went on before modern humans evolved. But if there was any, it was very little by comparison with what we do.
Thanks, Cliff, very much for the call. Alan, I want to ask you something a little different here. I know that you've been spending time recently at Stony Brook University on Long Island instructing scientists how to use improvisational acting techniques to express themselves more clearly. I think that's a really interesting project. There's all of this research going on. It's one of the wonderful things about this series to meet some of these people all over the world who are doing this remarkable work that we don't know very much about.
Interesting. I think my interest in trying to work with scientists and see if they can improve their ability to communicate to the rest of us, and then, in fact, to each other, it grew out of what Graham and I discovered as we did Scientific American Frontiers. We sort of embarked on an experiment there, and we didn't know what the outcome of it would be, where instead of just asking questions that I knew the answer to, which is the case in a lot of science interviews, I would actually ask questions that I needed to get the answer to understand it. And it sort of put the two of us in a dynamic situation where they really had to make me understand it. It wasn't enough that their story got told to the audience whether I got it or not. And as a result, I started to see scientists come alive in a way that they hadn't before when they were just giving a lecture. The lecture version of it would tend to be dry and without a lot of human interaction. So what I started to think was, in my own experience, when I studied improvising, I became more alive, and I noticed that other actors were much more alive and charismatic the more they studied improvising. So I thought, wouldn't it be an interesting experiment to put scientists through an improvising workshop and see what happens to them? And so far, they actually do seem to benefit from it. I don't want to make any claims for it that don't turn out to be true. I'm trying to approach it a little bit more like a scientist and look for evidence. But on the scanty evidence we have so far, it's very promising. On videotapes of these sessions, you can see a remarkable increase in their ability to. You see their eyes flashing. You see their voices become more animated. The kinds of words they use become more personal, and they're much easier to watch. And you remember what they say a lot better. So I'm exploring this with the scientists at various universities.
That's a great idea.
You're eliciting the human spark, Alan.
I think I am, yeah. But what's funny about it is we discovered it probably the way that modern humans discovered whatever it was that they discovered, which was just by accident. We just started doing it, and it all had to do with communication. What I'm doing with those scientists is exactly what we hear from many scientists is at the heart of what makes us human, which is to pay attention to one another, to teach one another, to be aware of what's in the other person's mind. That thing of the theory of mind, of wondering what the other person is thinking, which seems to be central to what we do, is exactly, without my giving thought to it, it turns out that's exactly what I keep asking the scientists to do when they talk to an audience. don't assume that they're getting it. Try to find out what they're thinking as you tell them, so that you say something to them that's appropriate to where they are at the moment, which I think is what most teachers do. You know,
yes.
They start off with where you are and take you from there. But that's what they're telling us that all humans did.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're out of time. This has been just fascinating. Direct us, please, again, Graham, to the website so people can get more information after they watch tonight's show and next week's show and the next week's show.
Yes, it's just www.pbs.org/humanspark.
Wonderful. Thank you both. It's been a wonderful hour.
Thank you. Thanks an awful lot, Kathleen.
Thank you.
And say hello to Walter Isaacson for me.
I sure will.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Our guest this hour, Alan Alda, and he is the host of the Human Spark series. It starts tonight on PBS. And we also thank Graham Ched, series producer of The Human Spark. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, John Treader for on-air production, and our studios in Milwaukee. We'll return following the news.